We now turn to the 31st chapter of Genesis, and we pick up the story of Jacob where we left off. We're really in the midst of a somewhat extended, I was going to say conflict, though it was more like a cold war than a hot war, between Jacob and Laban. There was no outright conflict, but there was certainly a lot of tension between the two and counter-maneuvering one another, trying to outmaneuver one another. Laban was a man whom we know was had as much appreciation as the next guy for money and for wealth. Jacob apparently liked the same thing, although Jacob was willing to work sometimes not for money but for love. He worked 14 years for his uncle, and his uncle in that time didn't treat him in such a way as to inspire trust in the relationship. For example, his uncle deceived him and gave him the wrong woman. After he'd worked 7 years for Rachel, he got the wrong woman. And so he agreed to work another 7 years and get Rachel. So Jacob, at least, though not a model of Christian virtue by any means, was a man who was willing to be a hard worker. And that, as a septuagenarian, as a person who's over 70 years old. And he seemed to deal fairly honestly with his uncle here. We don't read of any deception going on. But after 14 years, he is certainly willing to put some distance between himself and his uncle slash father-in-law. And his father-in-law was not so eager to see that happen because he had learned that Jacob's presence was that which had caused him to grow wealthy. He had started out with little when Jacob arrived and now was very wealthy. And he had found out through divination that it was the presence of Jacob in his household working in his employment that caused him to be blessed, that God was blessing Jacob and therefore blessing Laban for having given Jacob work. And so Laban talked Jacob into staying, told Jacob he could set his own wages. And so Jacob said, well, give me all the irregularly colored livestock of the sheep and of the goats. All the ones that are ordinarily colored, that'd be solid white sheep and solid black goats, will be yours, and that would certainly be the vast majority of the flock by any natural reasoning. But any irregular coloration, brown sheep, for example, or spotted or streaked or speckled goats, those would be Jacob's. Now, that sounded like a good proposal from Laban's point of view, because the vast majority of sheep and goats would therefore be Laban's by definition. Presuming the percentages of the coloration patterns remained as they normally would. And therefore, what Laban did apparently was he took all of the spotted and streaked and speckled breeding stock away so that Jacob could not use those to increase the number of offspring that would have those characteristics. And Jacob, we don't find Jacob complaining about that. To a large extent, he is aware that God is blessing his effort. We do read about a stratagem of Jacob's, which, as I said in the end of the last session, many have, I think, misunderstood. They have the impression that Jacob was pulling a fast one, and that this actually is an example of a flaw in the scriptures themselves, because we read of Jacob peeling the bark, or some of the bark, off of certain rods of wood, allowing a white streak to show where the bark had once been. And then he put these rods in the watering troughs of the animals at the time they were breeding. And we read that this caused the sheep to conceive. And it also says in verse 39 of chapter 30 that the flocks conceived before the rods, and the flocks brought forth streaked, speckled, and spotted. Now, because some of the livestock that came forth were streaked, and because the rods that were put in the water are also said to be streaked, it is perhaps a conclusion hastily jumped to by some critics that what is being suggested here is that the visual impact of seeing a streaked rod somehow marked the offspring to be born streaked also. And of course, this would not happen. This is scientifically ridiculous. It is possible that superstitious peoples may have thought such things at one time, but there's no reason to accuse Jacob of superstition. The man was not a novice when it comes to animal husbandry. As I said, he came from a long line of sheep herders and goat herders. Abram had probably thousands of head of sheep. He had a huge flock, and so did his father Isaac, who had inherited Abraham's flock and increased it. And so Jacob had grown up with sheep practically running through the bedroom, and he knew sheep and goats very well. It is not to be thought that people in ancient times were somehow more deficient in the area of IQ than modern people. That is perhaps a historically provincial opinion that we have, that 20th century people are somehow brainier than ancient people. The fact of the matter is we have more access to more information to store in our brains, but that doesn't mean we're sharper or able to process information at a higher level in terms of native intelligence than people were in ancient times. And certainly when three generations of sheep herders, especially when one generation lives to be almost 200 years old, so they can accumulate a lot of knowledge from experience, raise sheep, they can learn some things. And they probably learn by not only their own experience, but by shooting the breeze with other sheep herders at the old watering hole and so forth, and learning what works for them and trying that out and so forth. And what Jacob did worked. But we know that it wouldn't work in the way that some people think that Jacob tried to make it work. We know that it was not the case and would not be the case that by seeing striped sticks while breeding, that you sheep would produce streaked offspring. Nor does the Bible say that those two things were connected in that way. What we're told is that he put these streaked rods in the water so that the animals, verse 38, should conceive when they came to drink. It does not say that he in any sense sought to influence the coloration of their offspring. He simply put the rods in the water to cause the animals to become more fertile. Actually, in the Hebrew, the word conceive there in verse 38 actually literally means to become hot. So they would go into heat. It is not the case that it was the visual effect of these streaked rods, but rather the chemical effect of the rods that promoted fertility. We don't know in our modern times, at least I don't, of all of the qualities of the chestnut wood or almond wood or poplar wood, though it is known that certain herbal qualities in some plants and some trees do have an effect on causing fertility. There are such things as aphrodisiacs that cause sexual arousal or can cause an animal to encourage an animal to come into heat. And it would appear that Jacob was not, it does not say in any way that these rods were there to influence the color of the offspring. Simply, when the animals came to breed or to drink, he put them in so that they would be going to heat, so there'd simply be more offspring. Now, by the law of averages, more offspring would, of course, give him more, but his percentage would not be more than any or I mean, he just gets a certain percentage of animals come out streaked or whatever. And there's no reason to believe that he was trying to pull a fast one on Laban. What he was trying to do is increase the numbers of the flock generally. This would enhance Laban's wealth and Jacob's wealth. Of course Jacob wanted more offspring, but he had no way of believing that what he was doing was going to cause a larger percentage of the flock to be the color he wanted. As a matter of fact, it is hard to understand some of the things it says he did, especially in verse 40. It's not clear exactly what was going on when it says, Jacob separated the lambs and made the flocks face toward the streaked and all the brown of the flock of Laban. But he put his own flocks by themselves and did not put them in Laban's flock. It's not sure what he means he made them face Laban's flock. Laban's streaked and so forth were in fact 3 days' journey away. So I'm not sure what was going on here. But it is interesting that in verse 41 it says, it came to pass whenever the strong livestock conceived that Jacob placed the rods before the eyes of the livestock in the gutters that they might conceive among the rods. But when the flocks were feeble, he did not put them in, so that the feebler were Laban's and the stronger were Jacob's. Now, it does not say that he influenced the coloration. He just influenced the fertility. And he did this when the stronger animals were coming. He wanted to increase the fertility of the stronger animals. And he didn't do it when the feebler animals did. In other words, he was increasing the general quality of the herd in terms of strength and fitness for survival. The weaker animals, he didn't want them to reproduce as much, so he didn't put in the rods when they were breeding or drinking. But the stronger animals, he did. He wanted to encourage a larger flock in general, and a stronger flock in general. But it says, strangely, at the end of verse 42, so the feebler were Laban's and the stronger were Jacob's. Now this may make it sound like the rods that he put in when the stronger were there made these animals come out with strangely colored offspring that became Jacob's. And by not putting the rods in with the feebler came out with ordinary colors. Well, that does seem to be the outcome. But the Bible in no way suggests that Jacob intended that to be the outcome, nor does it say that that is really the explanation, that this happened because of the rods. Because it goes on in chapter 31 to give more detail, and what we read in the beginning of chapter 31 makes it very clear that Jacob didn't believe that these rods were causing this. He knew that God would do it, and God had to show him in a dream what was really going on genetically here. If you'll read with me the opening of chapter 31, now Jacob heard the words of Laban's sons, saying, Jacob has taken away all that was our father's, and from what was our father's he has acquired all his wealth. Now, of course, what they're seeing is that the percentage of the flocks are actually increasingly of the color pattern that belonged to Jacob and fewer of the color that belonged to Laban. And therefore, the sons of Laban, who stand to inherit whatever he has, see themselves losing out here by the diminishing of their father's herd. And Jacob saw the countenance of Laban, and indeed it was not favorable toward him as before. Then the Lord said to Jacob, return to the land of your fathers and to your kindred, and I will be with you. Now, we're not told it quite yet, but we will be told it soon after this, that 6 years had transpired. He had worked 14 years for the two wives, and since this new agreement had been made with Laban for the sheep and the goats to be so divided, 6 years had passed. And in those 6 years, an increasing percentage of the sheep and goats were the color patterns that benefited Jacob. And now after 6 years, or after a total of 20 years away from home, Jacob is told by God to go back to his home. So Jacob sent and called Rachel and Leah to the field to his flock and said to them, I see your father's countenance, that it is not favorable toward me as before. But the God of my father has been with me, and you know that with all my might I have served your father. Yet your father has deceived me and changed my wages 10 times, but God did not allow him to hurt me. If he said thus, the speckled shall be your wages, then all the flocks bore speckled. And if he said thus, the streaked shall be your wages, then all the flocks bore streaked. So God has taken away the livestock of your father and given them to me. And it happened at the time when the flocks conceived that I lifted up my eyes and saw in a dream. And behold, the rams which leaped upon the flocks were streaked, speckled, and gray spotted. Then the angel of God spoke to me in a dream, saying, Jacob, and I said, here am I. And he said, lift up your eyes now and see, all the rams which leap on the flocks are streaked, speckled, and gray spotted. For I have seen all that Laban is doing to you. I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed the pillar and where you made a vow to me. Now arise, get out of this land and return to the land of your kindred. Now do you see, there is more going on here than meets the eye as far as why the animals produced as they did, a higher percentage of irregular coloration of the offspring. Notice, Jacob was not the least bit in control of this, nor did he see himself in control. He says, your father, in the 6 years I've been laboring, has changed my wages 10 times. Now, I mean, that Laban, what a guy. You know, I mean, Jacob agrees as a favor to him to stay on with him, but on Jacob's terms. But Laban changes the terms. Initially, Jacob said, all the animals that are not solid colored, black goats, white sheep, are mine. Laban said, fine, I'll go for that. But when all of the animals started bearing spotted, then Laban came and changed the deal. Not the spotted ones. You only get the streaked ones. And Jacob says, as soon as he said that, then they all started bearing streaked ones. And so Laban came in and changed again. Okay, now all the spotted will be yours now, not the streaked ones. Then all of them start bearing spotted. Certainly the Bible doesn't indicate that these rods had such decisive power as to determine whether the offspring would be streaked or spotted or brown or whatever. I mean, he says God has taken away your father's livestock and given it to me. He sees it as sovereign. He sees it as something God has done. All that Jacob has done is tried to increase the number of animals and the quality of the animals. But God has determined what color the offspring are. And he sees it as God's doing, and God did it in response to the changes that Laban made. Laban would come 10 times and change things, hopefully for his own advantage, but every time he changed it, God produced more of the kind of offspring that the current agreement allowed to be Jacob's. So no matter what Laban did, God worked against him. Now, this dream that Jacob had is very interesting, because he says, I saw in a dream, and I saw all the rams leaping on the ewes, and all the fathers of the lambs. They happened to be, what does it say, spotted and streaked and speckled and gray-spotted. And not only did he say he saw that in verse 10, but the angel of the Lord specifically pointed out to him, says, Jacob, do you see this? Look at that. Look, lift up your eyes and see all the rams that leap on the flocks are streaked, speckled, and gray-spotted. Well, that's why the offspring came out that way, because of the genetics of the fathers. One thing, though, that's curious is, why did he need a dream to see that? I am suspecting that Jacob did not visibly see these color patterns on all the rams. I think they were probably in the genes, but not necessarily always visible on the coats or in the the sheep's wool, because obviously there can be recessive genes that do not come out in the color pattern of the individual, but can be passed on genetically. And it seems obvious that Jacob didn't know that these rams were that color. Well, he certainly would if they were outwardly that color. God knew the genetic patterns, and although to Jacob's eye and any natural eye, the rams that were breeding with the ewes were all just ordinary colored sheep. But God showed him in a dream, no, they're not. They're not. They're speckled. They're gray-spotted. They're ring-streaked, as the King James says. They have these... This is what they are inside. On the outside, they may be just plain old white rams. But it took a revelation from God to show him, no, they're not. Inside, there's something that doesn't appear. And the angel of the Lord had to call his attention to it. Now, he was an observant guy. If in fact visibly speckled and spotted rams were jumping on the ewes and mating them all, Jacob would have noticed that. He was an attentive shepherd. He certainly watched the animals breed. And he would not need a dream to show him this. It seems to me obvious that God saw something about these rams that Jacob couldn't, which required a revelation for Jacob to know. And that is that though the rams did not appear to be of the Jacob type, they actually were internally. Their genetics were, and that's why they reproduced offspring that color. Not because of any rods in the troughs, and not necessarily that Jacob ever thought the rods in the trough would influence color. He just used that because he had learned probably through the ages of experience that these particular woods, if you release the sap into the water, have some properties that will help enhance the animals going into heat. And that's all he did. He only encouraged general increase in size and quality of the flock. It was God and only God that influenced the outcome of the colors, and Jacob didn't even know why it was happening until God gave him a dream and showed him why. So to suggest that the closing verses of chapter 30 are saying that Jacob somehow maneuvered through this superstitious prenatal suggestion kind of an idea, the color of the offspring, is to miss the point. Jacob didn't maneuver this. He didn't even know why it was happening. No matter what Laban changed things to be, it turned out in Jacob's favor. And that is strictly attributed to God and not to anything Jacob did. Now, he tells the girls this. In fact, he calls them out into the field. He doesn't wait till he gets home for dinner to talk to them about this. Why? Why did he call them out into the field where he was watching the sheep to tell them? No doubt this had to be done in total secrecy. There were servants in the house. And if he began to talk to her over the dinner or anywhere in the house where the servants might overhear, news might get back to Laban that he was planning to leave. He had to leave in a hurry because he knew that if he left, he was taking a lot of flocks that Laban would covet. Laban was going to be left with very little behind. And that Laban had sons and friends in the area who could outnumber Jacob and his young sons. His oldest son was 13 years old, because his, well, or 12 years old. Reuben at this time couldn't be more than 12 years old, because Reuben was born in the 8th year of Jacob's stay there, because he had to labor 7 years to get his wife. Then Reuben was born the next year, the eighth year, and now it was the 20th year. So the oldest of the 11 sons was only 12 years old. So he wasn't going to be much good if it came to a fight between Laban's sons and friends and Jacob and his boys. So he had to sneak off, because he was quite sure that Laban would not allow Jacob to leave with all that loot, which, of course, legally was Jacob's, but Laban didn't care too much about that, about being honest. Jacob was quite sure that Laban would kill him, take his wives and children from him, and take the cattle from him. So he was plotting to escape under cover of darkness. Now, we know that Laban had established a residence 3 days' journey from Jacob. So Jacob would have a 6-day head start. Because if he would set off, a messenger from there going back to Laban would have to take 3 days to get to where Laban was. And then Laban would have to cover 3 days' journey back just to be where they started. So, I mean, he's going to have a 6-day head start, although he's not going to be able to go very fast. He's got a lot of livestock to drive. He's got little children. He's got women. Whereas Laban could pursue at, you know, attack speed on camels and so forth. So, I mean, it was not certain whether Jacob could make it all the way home before Laban caught him. And that is what this story goes on to point out. It was very, very close. And so he gets his wives in on the deal. And Rachel and Leah answered in verse 14 and said to him, "Is there still any portion or inheritance for us in our father's house? Are we not considered strangers by him? For he has sold us, and we are also, and also has completely consumed our money." They don't seem to appreciate the fact that he just treated them like pieces of property that could make him rich at Jacob's expense. "For all these riches which God has taken from our father are really ours and our children's. Now then, whatever God has said to you, do it." Then Jacob rose and set his sons and his wives on camels. And he carried away all his livestock and all his possessions which he had gained, his acquired livestock which he had gained in Paddan Aram, to go to his father Isaac in the land of Canaan. Now Laban had gone to shear his sheep, and Rachel had stolen the household idols that were in her father's house, apparently, or were her father's. These idols were not actually objects of worship in the sense of statues to bow down to. They were little, in the Hebrew the word is teraphim. Archaeologists who excavated the area know what teraphim were. They were little statues, maybe about a foot long, maybe smaller. And they were more symbolic than actual objects of worship. It is believed from what archaeologists have found of those ancient cultures that whoever possessed the family teraphim could lay claim to the family inheritance. It was sort of like having a king having a scepter. You know, the scepter is the symbol of his authority. If he loses his scepter, then his authority is in danger. Well, the possession of the family teraphim was like symbolic of being able to claim the inheritance. Now, obviously, Rachel's brothers, Laban's sons, would not be eager to see her get away with those, but no one knew at this point that she'd taken them. Shortly after this, Laban finds them missing and he's looking for them. But we are told at this point what no one else knows but Rachel, and that she's taken them and hidden them. And Jacob stole away, unknown to Laban the Syrian, in that he did not tell him that he intended to flee. So he fled with all that he had. He arose and crossed the river and headed toward the mountains of Gilead. Gilead is the region just across the River Jordan from the land of Canaan. Now remember, Isaac at this time was still in the land of Canaan. And that's where Jacob had fled from Esau, the land of Canaan. He's going back to the promised land. But he has to cross the Jordan to do that. And so he goes to the land of Gilead, or the mountains of Gilead, which are just across the river from Canaan. And Laban was told on the third day that Jacob had fled. This because, as we read in chapter 30 and verse 36, he was 3 days' journey away from where Jacob was, so it would take a messenger that long to get to him. So 3 days later, he hears about it. Then Laban took his brethren with him and pursued him for 7 days' journey and overtook him in the mountains of Gilead. Now, Jacob actually, as it were, had something like a 6-day head start. But because, let's put it this way. It took, from the day that Jacob left, it was 10 days till he was overtaken. Why? because 3 days Jacob was traveling before Laban heard about it. And then Laban traveled 7 days, another seven to the three. Jacob had been traveling for 10 days total. Laban caught him in 7 days. And therefore, that's not hard to imagine with Jacob, with all his livestock and everything moving along rather slowly, that Laban could catch up to him in 7 days, the distance that Jacob had gone in 10. The mountains of Gilead. I don't know exactly how far this is, but I read somewhere, and you hear different things. I never have really been able to have a chance to measure it myself, that this was a distance of about, I was told this was a distance of about 500 miles. Now, this actually was suggested by a skeptic who didn't believe the Bible, and he was pointing this out, that it's unrealistic. How could Jacob travel 500 miles in only 10 days? That would require that he traveled, on average, 50 miles a day. Now, for you and me to travel 50 miles a day, no problem. We can do that in an hour. But in those days, on foot, traveling 3 or 4, let's say they're moving fast, 5 miles an hour, that'd be 10 hours a day of walking at 5 miles an hour. And somehow some skeptic that was raising this as an objection said, that's not very realistic. How could a man do that? Well, I mean, why couldn't he go 5 miles an hour? I mean, that is a little fast. It's an uncomfortable speed to walk, but it can be done. As far as walking 10 hours, I mean, there's no reason he couldn't walk 12 hours. He might have gone 4 miles an hour and walked 12 hours a day. He might have even walked into the night. We don't know how many hours he walked. We know he was desperate to escape. And there's no reason to assume he just walked for 8 hours and then say, let's take a break here and camp out for about 12 hours. You know, I mean, in all likelihood, he just kept moving as much as he could, probably walked day and night and just stopped to sleep as necessary. There's no reason in the world that he couldn't make it in that period of time. But it does speak of a rather unnatural fast clip that he's moving at. It shows how eager he was to put distance between him and his uncle and how fearful he was that he might be caught, that he went so fast as he did. I understand that the pioneers coming out west, I think they covered on average about 20 or 25 miles a day in their travels, but they weren't running from somebody. They weren't running for their lives. Jacob apparently traveled about twice as much per day as the pioneer caravans traveled comfortably. Verse 24, but God had come to Laban the Syrian in a dream by night and said to him, be careful that you speak to Jacob neither good nor bad. Remember, we encountered that expression back in chapter 24 when the messenger or the servant of Abram told his story to Laban and to Bethuel, and they said, we can speak neither good nor bad about this. Now we have that expression again here. And it, when you consider both places where the expression appears, and it would seem, and it appears, by the way, in verse 29, no? Yeah, in verse 29 here also. It seems like the expression, speak neither good nor bad, is an idiomatic expression that in their culture must have meant something like, don't interfere. That would fit all the various appearances of that expression. If it meant something like, don't interfere, then that would make sense in the various places that it is used. Although it would obviously be a Hebraism that is not literal, don't speak either good or bad. Laban obviously felt like he was obeying God when he came and told Jacob this, and he was speaking. So obviously it didn't mean don't say anything. So Laban overtook Jacob. Now Jacob had pitched his tent in the mountains, and Laban with his brethren pitched in the mountains of Gilead. And Laban said to Jacob, what have you done that you have stolen away unknown to me and carried away my daughters like captives taken with the sword? Why did you flee away secretly and steal away from me and not tell me? For I might have sent you away with joy and songs, with timbrel and harp. Fat chance. And you did not allow me to kiss my sons and my daughters. Now you have done foolishly in so doing. It is in my power to do you harm, but the God of your father spoke to me last night, saying, be careful that you speak to Jacob neither good nor bad. And now you have surely gone because you greatly long for your father's house. But why did you steal my gods? Referring to the teraphim that Rachel had taken. Now Jacob answered and said to Laban, because I was afraid. Now he doesn't answer the gods part first. He answers the first question first. Why did you leave without telling me? His answer is, because I was afraid. For I said, perhaps you would take your daughters from me by force. Now he answers the part about the gods. With whomever you find your gods, do not let him live. In the presence of our brethren, identify what I have of yours and take it with you. For Jacob did not know that Rachel had stolen it. Now, Jacob is indignant because he has taken pains over the past 6 years to have his arrangements with his father-in-law such that no one could accuse him, Jacob, of stealing. That's why he had that plain difference between the colors of the sheep and the goats, so that no one could ever accuse him of stealing from his father-in-law. He wanted to make it clear that if he got rich, it was fairly and honestly. And he says, listen, I don't have anything of yours here. Go ahead and search the tents. Kill whoever you find it with, because he was quite sure that the accusation was false. He didn't know that, in fact, the accusation was true. And Laban went into Jacob's tent, into Leah's tent, and into the two maids' tents. But he did not find them. Then he went out of Leah's tent and entered Rachel's tent. Now, Rachel had taken the household idols and put them in the camel's saddle and sat on them. The camel's saddles were not just like horse saddles. They were actually like pieces of furniture. A camel's back is not the same shape as a horse's back. A man or a woman can sit on a horse's back considerably more comfortably than on a camel's, especially a dromedary camel, which is probably what they had, a single hump. And that hump is made of fat. It's not a solid thing you can sit on. It wobbles around and so forth. How are you going to sit on an animal like that? Well, they had a saddle kind of structure that was built up out of wood and leather and so forth, and it was actually something that could stand up on its own when it wasn't on the camel. It had to give a different shape to the camel's back. It had to be built up around the hump and so forth so that they could ride on it. And typically, when they'd camp, they'd take the camel's saddle off and bring it into the tent and use it as a piece of furniture. And apparently there was room to store stuff underneath it. So she had put them under the camel's saddle, and she was sitting on it in the tent. And Laban searched all about the tent, but did not find them. And she said to her father, "Let it not displease my lord that I cannot rise before you, for the manner of women is with me." And he searched, but he did not find the household idols. Now she said she couldn't rise for him to search the camel saddle because the manner of women was with her. Now that could mean one of two things. It either means that she was pregnant, and some people believe she was at this time pregnant with Benjamin, the last of the children to be born to her, and I suppose it maybe is conceivable that she was pregnant with Benjamin, but that would not be a very good explanation why she couldn't stand up. I mean, pregnant women can stand up. The other possibility, she's saying that she had her period. Now, of course, a woman with a period can stand up too, but under Middle Eastern custom and later under the law of Moses, a woman during her period was unclean, and anything she sat on was unclean, and anyone who came into contact with anything she sat on was also made unclean. There were strong aversions to physical contact with women or anything they had contact with during their period. And that would make sense. While she could stand up, she's not denying that she can stand up. She's saying there's no need to. She has her period in all likelihood. Therefore, the saddle's defiled. Laban wouldn't want to touch it anyway. So no sense in her standing up and letting him search it. He wouldn't want to, knowing that she is in that condition. So by doing so, she prevents the saddle from being searched. And, of course, Jacob feels very vindicated and angry at having been, as he thinks, falsely accused. So Jacob now has the upper hand because there's witnesses there. If it was just between Laban and Jacob, Laban might not be so humbled. But here there's witnesses, Laban's brethren, some of his neighbors probably are with him, his sons. He's come on like gangbusters making all these accusations, and now he looks kind of silly. He's got egg on his face. He didn't find what he's looking for, and he's been making all these bold accusations, accusing Jacob of wrongdoing, and Jacob stands pretty well vindicated. And so Jacob's in the bargaining position now. He can vent his spleen a little bit and let hang out all the things he's built up in there for the past 20 years, and he just kind of spews it all out here. Jacob was angry and rebuked Laban, and Jacob answered and said to Laban, "What is my trespass? What is my sin that you have so hotly pursued me? Although you have searched all my things, what part of your household things have you found? Set it here before my brethren and your brethren, that they may judge between both of us." In other words, there were witnesses there, and one of them should be embarrassed. Jacob isn't embarrassed because they found nothing. Laban, go ahead. If you want to be unembarrassed in front of these people, go ahead and give the evidence that you're right, of which there was clearly none. He says, "These 20 years I have been with you. Your ewes and your female goats have not miscarried their young. I have not eaten the rams of your flock. That which was torn by beasts I did not bring to you. I bore the loss of it. You required it from my hand, whether stolen by day or stolen by night. There I was. In the day, the drought consumed me. In the frost by night, and my sleep departed from my eyes. Thus have I been in your house 20 years. I served you 14 years for your 2 daughters and 6 years for your flock. And you have changed my wages 10 times. Unless the God of my father, the God of Abraham, the fear of Isaac, meaning the God that Isaac feared, again, he's not my God yet, had been with me, surely now you would have sent me away empty-handed. God has seen my affliction and the labor of my hands and rebuked you last night. Well, Laban, we find, answers in a very humbled and humiliated and chastened way. But before we read his response, I want to clarify what is being said in verse 39. When Jacob says, that which was torn by beasts I didn't bring to you, and I bore the loss of it. You required it from my hand, whether stolen by day or stolen by night. Customarily, ranch hands and livestock care people were responsible not for theft nor for wild animals taking the sheep. Later on, even in the Jewish law, a shepherd was not to be held accountable to his employer if an animal was taken by a wild animal or by a thief while the shepherd slept. The shepherd could not be required to stay awake night and day and watch every moment. Now, if the animal was taken any other way, then if by any negligence on the part of the caregiver, then that caregiver would be responsible and have to pay for the loss. But it was common custom among shepherds that they were allowed to sleep at night, and therefore if a sheep was stolen by thieves or by an animal, all they had to do was produce the evidence of it, bring the mangled remains of it and present it and show that it had been so treated if possible, or that in otherwise prove that it had been stolen, and he wouldn't have to bear the loss of it. Laban, however, was more severe with Jacob than the average. He required Jacob to pay for any losses, even that happened during the night. And so Jacob says, my sleep departed from my eyes. I had to stay awake night and day. Here the guy's in his 90s now. He's almost 100 years old. He's 97 years old right now. And he hasn't gotten any sleep for the last 6 years. Or maybe the last 20. I mean, any sleep. Of course, he slept some. He's caught sleep when he could. But he couldn't sleep restfully because he knew that if anyone would come and take the sheep while he was asleep, he'd have to pay for them. It'd come out of his paycheck. So he's saying, I didn't ever have any rest when I was working for you. You were unreasonably severe, changing my wages 10 times, placing burdens on me that are unheard of in this profession. You've been a very, unkind employer. And it has not been an easy life for me working for you. And God has finally come to my aid and rebuked you. And he's also taken away your herds and given them to me. Now, Laban, of course, couldn't answer this. All of it was true. All the things that had been bugging Jacob about Laban for 20 years had all come out in front of witnesses and so forth. And Laban couldn't refute one word of it. And so Laban answered in verse 43 and answered. He said to Jacob, these daughters are my daughters. These children are my children. And this flock is my flock. All that you see is mine. But what can I do this day to these my daughters and to their children from whom they have born? Now, therefore, come, let us make a covenant, you and I, and let it be a witness between you and me. So Jacob took a stone and set it up as a pillar. He'd done that once before, 20 years earlier, in a different location. Then Jacob said to his brethren, and his brethren here must have been Laban's brethren who had come with Laban, gather stones. And they took stones and made a heap, and they ate there on that heap. Laban called it Jegar Sahadutha, but Jacob called it Galeed. Actually, these two names for this have exactly the same meaning, but in different languages. Laban spoke Aramaic. He was Syrian. And what is it? Jegar Sahadutha is the Aramaic term for a heap of witness, a heap of stones that would be a witness. Galeed means exactly the same thing in Hebrew. Jacob's language is Hebrew, and so he just called it Galeed. They both called it by the same name. The thing was called the heap of witness, but Jacob called by its Hebrew name and Laban by its Aramaic name. And Laban said, this heap is a witness between you and me this day. Therefore, its name was called Galeed, the heap of witness. Also, it's called Mizpah, which means watch, literally, because he said, may the Lord watch between you and me when we are absent one from another. If you afflict my daughters, or if you take other wives besides my daughters, although no man is with us, see, God is witness between you and me. Then Laban said to Jacob, here is this heap, and here is this pillar, which I have placed between you and me. This heap is a witness, and this pillar is a witness, that I will not pass beyond this heap to you, and you will not pass beyond this heap and this pillar to me for harm. The God of Abraham, the God of Nahor, the God of their father, judge between us. Of course, Laban is assuming that the God of Terah, who worshipped other gods, is also the God of Abraham and Nahor. He's a bit naive in that respect. But it's probable that although Laban believed in Jehovah, he probably believed in other gods too. After all, he had teraphim in his house. And Jacob swore by the fear of his father Isaac, which is Jehovah, the God that Isaac feared. He's called the fear of his father Isaac. Notice Jacob is still not at this point fearing the Lord himself, not in the sense of worshiping and committing himself to the Lord. But his father did, and so he swears by the God my father Isaac feared. Then Jacob offered a sacrifice on the mountain and called his brethren to eat bread. And they ate bread and stayed all night on the mountain. And early in the morning Laban arose and kissed his sons and daughters and blessed them. Then Laban departed and returned to his place. Chapter 32, so Jacob went on his way, and the angels of God met him. Now, as he's about to enter the promised land, the angels meet him. They had met him as he was leaving, too, 20 years earlier. He dreamed, and he saw the angels ascending and descending on this ladder. So it's as if whenever he crossed the borders of the promised land, he saw the angels there. It's as if they stood around the land like a bodyguard around the land of Canaan, guarding the promised land. And Laban, Jacob saw them coming and going. And when Jacob saw them, he said, this is God's camp. And he called the name of that place Mahanaim. Now, Mahanaim in the Hebrew means double camp. And it sounds like he called it double camp because he saw God's camp, the angels there. And, of course, there was his own camp. So there are two camps there, his camp, and then he saw that the angels were camped there, too. So there's a double camp. But later on, in this chapter in verse 10, he makes mention of the fact that he has himself become two companies because he split his own camp into two. And it's possible that Mahanaim has a double meaning, as well as meaning double camp in the sense of my camp and God's camp. It's also Jacob's camp became two camps, a double camp. But anyway, the place is called Mahanaim. Then Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau, his brother, in the land of Seir, the country of Edom. And he commanded them, saying, speak thus to my lord Esau. Thus your servant Jacob says, I have sojourned with Laban and stayed there until now. I have oxen, donkeys, flocks, and male and female servants. And I have sent to tell my lord that I may find favor in your sight. Now last he heard Esau wanted to kill him. But 20 years has passed, and of course it's not likely that Esau would still be as angry as before, he hopes. 20 years is a long time to hold a grudge, and even if you do hold a grudge, some people do hold grudges for 20 years, still the edge of their anger would be a bit dulled after 20 years. I mean, the fact that a man may still be angry doesn't mean he'd still kill you if he got a chance. A man may feel angry enough to kill someone at one point, but after 20 years, though he's still angry, he may not be, he's dealt with it. You know, he's learned how to live with it. He's not so sure he wants to become a murderer over it anymore. And so he's hoping that Esau might forgive him, or if not, might at least tolerate him. And he's sending messengers ahead just to make sure. He doesn't want to show up and be surprised by Esau's attitude. So he sends messengers ahead to greet Esau and tell him that Jacob's coming. Verse 6, then the messengers returned to Jacob, saying, we came to your brother Esau, and he also is coming to meet you, and 400 men are with him. So Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed. And he divided the people that were with him, and the flocks, and herds, and camels, into two companies. And he said, if Esau comes to the one company and attacks it, then the other company which is left will escape. Then Jacob said, O God of my father Abraham, and God of my father Isaac, Jehovah, who said to me, return to your country and to your kindred, and I will deal well with you. I am not worthy of the least of all your mercies and of all the truth which you have shown your servant. For I crossed over this Jordan with my staff only, and now I have become two companies. Deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, lest he come and attack me and the mother and with the children. For you said, I will surely treat you well, and make your descendants as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude. Now, of course, the messengers have not mentioned whether Esau is coming with hostility or not, but it's assumed that if Esau wanted to come out and greet his brother on friendly terms, he wouldn't need a welcoming committee of 400 men. Why would Esau, if not to do some harm? And therefore, Jacob assumes the worst. Here comes Esau with 400 men. You know, we never do learn whether Esau was hostile at this point or not. We do have a meeting between the two that happens in the next chapter, but by this time we find Esau is not angry, but was he angry when he left, when he started on this trip? We never find out. It is hard to imagine that Esau would have brought 400 men with him if he was not angry, but we'll deal with those questions a little later. All I can say is that Jacob assumed the worst, and therefore he thought, well, some of us are going to be attacked. Maybe if I put some distance between half of my entourage and the other half, then only one half will be wiped out and the others can escape while the others are being slaughtered. Well, that's not a very consoling thought. You know, well, half of my family is going to be slaughtered only. But that's the best he thought he could do. You know, I mean, it's better than everybody. You can imagine that he didn't have a very restful night. And as we read on, he surely did not have a restful night. In fact, he spent the night wrestling, as it turns out. But the first thing he does is try to take some precautions against losing the whole family. He divides them into two companies and puts a little distance between them so that whichever one might be attacked, the other would have a chance to escape. Then he prays. Now, he still doesn't say that God is his God, although God has come very close to fulfilling all the terms that Jacob laid out at Bethel. When Jacob said, if you provide for me, if you clothe me, if you feed me, if you keep me safe, bring me safe to my family, then you'll be my God. Well, God has done most of that. He certainly has prospered him, fed him, clothed him, kept him safe from Laban and so forth, but he's not yet back safely with his family, and it looks like maybe there's an obstacle there, and that is Esau. So Jacob is not yet considering himself obligated to fulfill his agreement with God, since God has not yet fully satisfied all the terms that Jacob laid out. But he does pray for mercy anyway. He says, God, you've shown me mercy. I don't deserve any of them. You prosper me. I used to have only a staff when I crossed this Jordan last time. Now I'm going back over the same river the other direction. I've got so much wealth, I can divide it into two huge encampments. In other words, he's just making a graphic reference to the amount of prosperity and blessing he's received from God, which he admits he does not deserve. And he says, he prays specifically for deliverance in verse 11, for himself and the mothers and the children. And he reminds God in verse 12, of what God said. God said, for you said, I will surely treat you well and make your descendants as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude. Now, if Jacob really believed that promise, he shouldn't be afraid that his family is going to be wiped out, because he has not yet become like the sand of the seashore for multitude. This has a future fulfillment, but it could not be fulfilled if Esau wiped them all out. But he's not fully confident that God's going to answer this prayer. He's just reminding God, remember what you said? You said this, so I'm kind of counting on you to be bound by your own promise here. And by the way, there's not anything wrong with holding God to his promises in the sense of when praying to utter and remind God of the scriptures or the promises that you're basing your expectation on. This was done even by the New Testament apostles in the book of Acts. They prayed and said, God, you are the one who said through David, why did the heathen rage and the people imagine vain thing? And they quote a long thing about what God had said. It's not that they think God has forgotten what he said. It's rather that they're referencing the thing that God said that becomes the occasion of their praying right now. God, you said you'd do this, and I'm just counting on you to do that. That's not because God has forgotten. It might even be largely for the sake of the person praying to remember what the Word of God is, to increase their faith, that God might in fact grant their prayer viewed in light of his promises. Anyway, after Jacob prays, he's still not at ease because he doesn't really know God. He can pray, but people who aren't in relation with God can pray and still be nervous because they don't know God well enough to know whether it can be trusted. So it says, verse 13, he lodged there that same night and took what came to his hand as a present for Esau, his brother, 200 female goats and 20 male goats, 200 ewes and 20 rams. 30 milk camels and their colts. That doesn't mean they necessarily drank the milk from the camels, but they were nursing young, apparently. 40 cows and 10 bulls. 20 female donkeys and 10 foals. Then he delivered them to the hand of his servants. By the way, that's a pretty big flock there. 200 female sheep, 200 female goats, and about one male per 10 of those, plus 30 camels with their calves, plus 40 cows and 10 bulls. I mean, that'd be a pretty good little homestead to start out with, just right there. I mean, that's a wealthy gift. He's very rich, and he's able to give a gift like that, which he hopes will save his life by his apparent generosity. Then he delivered them to the hand of his servants, and they drove by itself, every drove by itself, and said to his servants, "Pass over before me and put some distance between successive droves." And he commanded the first one, saying, "When Esau, my brother, meets you and asks you, saying, 'To whom do you belong and where are you going? Whose are these in front of you?' Then you shall say, 'They are your servant Jacob's. It is a present sent to my lord Esau. And behold, he also is behind us.' So he commanded the second and the third and all who followed the drove, saying, 'In this manner you shall speak to Esau when you find him. And also say, Behold, your servant Jacob is behind us. For he said, I will appease him with the present that goes before me, and afterward I will see his face. Perhaps he will accept me.' So the present went on over before him, and he himself lodged in the night, that night in the camp." We see that although he has prayed for deliverance, he still takes matters strictly into his own hands. He hopes to psychologically manipulate the situation with Esau. If Esau is angry, he's going to try to wear down his anger by stages. Send these 220 goats ahead with one servant and say, "This is a gift for Esau." If Esau keeps coming, then he's going to run into the 220 sheep and get the same message. And then if he keeps coming after that and he's still angry, he's going to hit the camel drove and then the cow drove and so forth. Eventually, it's going to wear down his hostility when he receives gift after gift after gift, generous gift. He doesn't give them all at once. He's going to exploit the situation as much as he can. Instead of just having one big group of livestock say, "Here's a gift," if Esau is not disposed to receive a gift but is just plain angry, he may ignore the whole thing and keep coming. But if he hits one wave of generous gift after another wave, it is suspected by Jacob that bit by bit his hostility is going to be assuaged. He's going to be hit again and again and again with the evidence of Jacob's generosity toward him and so forth, and eventually that's going to chip away at his anger. That's what he thinks. And he says this way, "I'll appease him with the present." Well, even this did not give Jacob any rest. Because he couldn't rest in the Lord, even though he had prayed, he didn't fully trust the Lord. And he could not rest even though he resorted to every stratagem he could think of. He divided his people into two camps so that one half might survive if the other were attacked. He prayed, since of course everyone's got to do that when they're in trouble, and whether it means anything to him or not. And then he also tried to bribe or buy off Esau, obviously thinking that his prayer wasn't going to pull it off. He's going to have to do something himself. Jacob is a man of cleverness. He's a man of great resources. He's a man of physical strength. Even in his old age, we find he's rather unusually strong physically, as the next little paragraph demonstrates. And he is a man of personal strength. But he is about to enter the promised land. And he's about to own God as his God. But God wants first for something to happen to him. He is a man who's lived by his wits and by his conniving and by his own natural native strength. And he's never trusted anyone but himself. Sure, he's talked to God. Sure, he's prayed to God. But even then, he trusts in his own wits. He doesn't trust in God. Jacob is just strong enough to be able to trust in himself. And therefore, the next little paragraph, I believe, demonstrates that God was not quite ready for Jacob to re-enter the promised land in this condition. He had to first be broken. He had to first come to a place where he was at the end of himself, where he would no longer be able to trust in his own strength. And he would have to surrender to God. And it says in verse 22 that he arose that night and took his two wives and his two maidservants and his 11 sons and crossed over the ford of Jabbok. Now, I'm not sure exactly what direction he's going here, because we don't know exactly where he put his two companies. But even after he'd done everything that's described so far, he still can't sleep. He gets up from bed. He takes further precautions, takes the people most important to him, his wives and children, and puts them in yet another place, hopefully more safe than the others. But even then, there is no peace. And he took them and sent them over the brook, and he sent over what he had. Then Jacob was left alone. And a man wrestled with him until the breaking of the day. Now when he saw that he did not prevail against him, that is, the man did not prevail against Jacob, he touched the socket of Jacob's hip, and the socket of Jacob's hip was out of joint as he wrestled with him. And he said, "Let me go, for the day breaks." But he said, Jacob said, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." So the man said to him, "What is your name?" And he said, "Jacob." And he said, "Your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel. For you have struggled with God and with men and have prevailed." And Jacob asked him, saying, "Tell me your name, I pray." And he said, "Why is it that you ask after my name?" And he blessed him there. And Jacob called the name of that place Peniel, which means face of God. For, he says, "I have seen God face to face, and my life is preserved." Just as he crossed over Peniel, which is another way of saying Peniel, just named, the sun arose on him, and he limped on his hip. Therefore, to this day, the children of Israel do not eat the muscle, meaning of their beef and their sheep, that shrank, which is on the hip socket, because he touched the socket of Jacob's hip in the muscle that shrank. Now, this story is weird. I mean, it's mysterious. It's bizarre. I mean, everything else makes reasonably good sense up till now, but this is really strange. Jacob is, in the middle of the night, left sleepless, nervous, alone, expecting his brother to show up and maybe kill him, and all of a sudden there's a man there wrestling with him. The man is not Esau, the one he thought might want to come and do harm to him, nor is the man identified with any other ordinary man. It's not Laban. Laban hasn't come back and decided he wasn't so going to let him off that easy. This man is not identified by name. And it's not stated why this man has any hostility toward Jacob. He just wrestles with them all night. Now, there is much evidence to believe that this man was God. Now, God is not a man, but we have already discussed previously the fact that there is such a thing in the Old Testament as a theophany. That's a theological term taken from the Greek word theos, which means God, and phineo, which means appearance. A theophany is an appearance of God in an actual physical form. It is probable, I have said, that Melchizedek was an instance of a theophany. And if he was or wasn't, we know that there was at least a theophany that appeared to Abraham in Genesis 18. God appeared to him and told him he was going to go into Sodom and Gomorrah, but not before God had had a meal and had his feet washed. Obviously, God was in a human form, a physical, tangible human form. This happens in the Old Testament from time to time. God appears for the time being, for the sake of an encounter, in a human physical form. In a sense, the birth of Jesus into the world was the ultimate theophany. But the difference between that, what we call the incarnation, when Jesus came to the world, and the theophanies of the Old Testament, is that in the Old Testament, these theophanies appeared as fully grown men, appeared suddenly, did what they had to do, and then left. Whereas in the case of the incarnation, of course, Jesus actually came through a human mother as a baby, grew up, lived a lifetime, died, and so forth, which is certainly, although in principle, maybe very much like the theophanies of the Old Testament, an appearance of God in a human form, but in many ways different, certainly a unique appearance. Some people believe that this man was none other than Jesus prior to his incarnation, though that couldn't be established. One thing that does seem to be established is it was an encounter with God. Now, whether this happened symbolically or in a dream or physically has been debated. There are many people who think that we have here a description of a bad dream that Jacob had, simply because it seems incredible that God, in a physical form, would just jump on the guy while he's down and start wrestling him to the ground. But that it is a dream doesn't seem to satisfy all the details, because it was in the course of this wrestling that Jacob was crippled in the thigh, and the next day he was limping. You know, you may have a dream that you fell off a cliff and broke your neck, but when you wake up, your neck is not broken. And so it would appear there was an actual physical encounter here with an unnamed man. But the reason for identifying this man with God is, well, there's a number of reasons. For one thing, the man was Jacob's superior, very clearly, because Jacob said, "I won't let you go till you bless me." It says in the Hebrews, book of Hebrews, chapter 7, without any contradiction, the lesser man is always blessed by the better man. Abraham had received a blessing from Melchizedek. Jacob is now asking for a blessing from this man. It is the inferior man, according to Scripture, who seeks and obtains a blessing from the superior. Therefore, by saying, "I won't let you go unless you bless me," Jacob is acknowledging the man as his superior. Furthermore, the man doesn't just bless him, he renames him. This, again, is the prerogative of someone who is a superior, and most often the prerogative of God himself. It was God who renamed Abram to be Abraham, who renamed Sarai to be Sarah. It was Jesus himself who renamed Simon to be called Peter. And other renamings take place in the Scripture as well. Here, it is no doubt none other than God himself renaming Jacob, whose name means supplanter, to the name Israel, which means a prince with God, which suggests that this is an encounter, perhaps the encounter, that was the conversion experience of Jacob. It was the last thing he had known about God. It's interesting how complex a man's relationship with God is portrayed in Scripture, as opposed to the simple thing, like so many people think, well, you say a sinner's prayer and then you're a person of God and nothing changes ever after that. It's just a static thing. You're either a believer or an unbeliever. In real relations between humans and God, there are many thresholds crossed. There are many stages. It's very hard for me to tell you when I was really saved. I know I went for it at an altar call when I was 4, but I went for it at another altar call when I was 10. And then I was filled with the Spirit when I was 16, and that was a major change. I don't know when I got saved. I don't even care. All I care about is that I am saved now. I don't have to interpret my personal history in such a way as to know the exact moment I got saved. All I can say is that God clearly saved me, and he took me through stages in the development of my relationship with him, beginning with me being raised in a Christian home and knowing with my head certain things and making certain commitments, crossing certain thresholds at different points. It's a complex thing. The relationship with God is a real relationship. It's not just a static thing. And so many people think, well, you're going to hell until you say the sinner's prayer, and then you're going to heaven. And that's all there is to it. As if it isn't really a relationship like any other relationship. God was bringing Jacob in by stages to a knowledge of himself. It's very hard to say at what point Jacob got saved. He was raised in a God-fearing home, but he didn't know God. He met God at Bethel in a dream, but he didn't commit himself to God. Even now he hasn't committed himself to God, but he has prayed in desperation, begging God for mercy and for deliverance. And we find in the next chapter that God answers that prayer. But now here's another encounter with God, a much more profound encounter. God has appeared in a dream and talked to him a couple of times, but now God's wrestling with him. No doubt it's a symbolic thing. I'm sure it happened literally. I'm personally sure that this was a literal wrestling match between the man Jacob and a man, that is God in a human form, wrestling with him. But the purpose of it was to portray something symbolic. And we'll talk in a moment about what that is. But anyway, the fact that the man renamed him as a prince with God suggests that he is perhaps owning him now. That this is the point where Jacob actually surrenders to God and begs God for the blessing. And that this is the point where Jacob, forever after this, is God is his God too. He acknowledges this, by the way, later on in chapter 33 in verse 20. At the end of this next chapter, after his encounter with Esau, which we haven't read of yet. But when that encounter is over, in Genesis 33:20, Jacob, or now his name is Israel, builds an altar. It says, and there he called it El Elohe Israel, which means God, the God of Israel. And remember, Israel is him, Jacob. He's Israel. So for the first time, Jacob builds an altar and calls God his own God. He is now not just the God of Abraham, my grandfather, not just the fear of Isaac, my father. He is God, the God of me, Israel, me, Jacob. And so we can see that there's a transaction in this encounter with God that takes place, where Jacob is no longer the person who just knows who God is, but hasn't made any commitment. Here is where he surrenders to God, and from this day forward, God is the God of Israel. He's the God of Jacob. He's the God of this man. And that suggests something, probably what we would call conversion at this point. And many people are converted only after a wrestling match with God. Not physically necessarily, but they wrestle with it. They realize the surrender that it involves. They realize that from this day forward, they can't trust in themselves, their own strength. They've got to surrender to God. They've got to beg God's blessing because they can't help themselves. And when a person wrestles with those things and his pride is put away and he's finally willing to surrender, that's often what brings a person to full actual conversion. But notice this, that it was God is further indicated by the fact that in verse 30, Jacob called the place Peniel, the face of God, because it says, I've seen God face to face and my life is preserved. Obviously, he felt like he had seen God there. And so did the Jews, because in verse 32 it says, from that day forward, the Jews would never eat that part of the body of an animal that corresponded to that part of Jacob's body that was touched by the man. Why? Because it was touched by God. That made it sacred. They can't eat that. It's just like the Philistines at a later date in 1 Samuel. We read that because their god Dagon had his head and hands cut off and they were sitting on the threshold of their temple, they never would walk on that threshold anymore. It's sacred. They always jump over the threshold and go into the temple because to the Philistine pagan mind, the threshold of Dagon's temple has become sacred by Dagon's head and hands have been put on it. And so to the Jew, God's hand had touched the thigh of Jacob, and that made the thigh forever sacred. And the Jews wouldn't even eat the thigh of animals after that because of that. You can see that the Jews and Jacob himself certainly understood this to be an encounter with God himself in a physical form. Now, this story is referred to briefly in Hosea, which is the first of the minor prophets, right after Daniel. In Hosea chapter 12, verses 2 through 4, and it says, the Lord also brings a charge against Judah and will punish Jacob according to his ways. Judah and Jacob are here not the individuals, but the nation and the tribe. According to his deeds, he will recompense him. He, meaning Jacob the man, took his brother by the heel in the womb. And in his strength, he struggled with God. Yes, he struggled with the angel and prevailed. He wept and sought favor from him. He found him in Bethel, and there he spoke to us. Now, notice there's sort of a summary of some of the things that are said about Jacob. He caught his brother's heel when he came out of the womb, but then it jumps immediately from his birth to his rebirth, when he struggled with God. Now, it does say in verse 4, yes, he struggled with the angel. But as I said earlier, many scholars believe the angel, meaning the angel of the Lord, is simply a theophany, the appearance, the messenger of the Lord. And while it says he struggled with the angel in verse 4, verse 3 says he struggled with God. It is God who appeared to him in the form of the angel of the Lord, a physical form like a man. But notice also it says that Jacob wept in verse 4 and sought favor from him. Now on one hand, Jacob wrestled and prevailed. In fact, the very name Israel was given to him, a prince with God, because he struggled with God and with man and prevailed. In one sense, Jacob prevailed. But in another sense, he was not in the bargaining position where he says, I won't let you go unless you bless me. According to Hosea, he was weeping when he said that. He was at his wit's end. He was an emotional wreck. You know, you read the story in Genesis, it sounds like Jacob had the upper hand in this fight. He's wrestling all night with this man. And when it says the man saw that he could not prevail against Jacob, he then touched him. He touched the socket of his hip. I'm talking about Genesis 32, verse 25. When the man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob, he touched Jacob in the socket of his hip and crippled him, basically, for life. Even then, Jacob didn't let go. Because the man that said, let me go, the day breaks, I need to get out of here. But Jacob said, I'm not going to let you go unless you bless me. It almost sounds like Jacob's in the bargaining position here. I'm not letting go until I get what I want from you. But he's weeping at this time. He's broken. He wrestled all night and God still couldn't get him to break. The man was too strong. in his own strength. He was too capable of trusting in his own abilities and strength. He's a brilliant man, and a rich man, and a strong man. And even one would say, in comparison to the people he'd been associated with, Laban, he was a righteous man in his own character. But he was not righteous in the character of God. He was not a man of God. He was just a man of fleshly strength and ability. And his fleshly strength until now had always been able to hold him in good stead. He'd faced many crises in his life, but he'd always gotten through them. He had gotten the blessing when it seemed like it was impossible. He got it. He had escaped from Esau. He had beat out Laban in connivings, ultimately. He came out ahead. Basically, without surrendering to God, he had nonetheless managed to take care of himself. But now he was facing something that seemed even beyond himself. He'd done everything he could to assuage the guilt, the anger of Esau, but he still had no security because he wasn't yet surrendered to God and trusting in God completely. And this is what this encounter signified, that Jacob had to be brought to the place where he wasn't trusting in his own strength anymore. And the only way to do that was to take away his strength, cripple him, make him a cripple. And symbolically, God had to, I mean, he literally crippled him, but I think the symbolism that is implied is that God had to weaken the man, bring the man to the end of himself where his own strength was no longer something that could be counted on, to bring him to the end of his rope. You know, the Apostle Paul said that God deals with people that way. In fact, he dealt with Paul that way. If you look at 2 Corinthians chapter 1, 2 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 8 and following, Paul said, "For we do not want you to be ignorant, brethren, of our trouble which came to us in Asia, that we were burdened beyond measure, above strength." That is, the burden God allowed us to bear was more than our strength could endure. He brought us to the end of our rope. It was beyond our strength to endure, so that we despaired even of life. Yes, verse 9, we had the sentence of death in ourselves, that we should not trust in ourselves, but in God who raises the dead. Now notice, he says, God had put us in a circumstance that was beyond the capacity of our own strength to endure. Why? Because he wanted us not to trust in our own strength. He wanted us to trust in him who raises the dead. He took us to the point where death was seemingly inevitable. We could do nothing to save our lives. But God put us in that position so we'd trust in him who raises the dead instead of ourselves. God will often do everything he has to do to bring a man to a point beyond the point of his own strength so that the man has to trust in God. Later in 2 Corinthians, of course, 2 Corinthians 12, Paul says in verse 7, "And lest I should be exalted above measure by the abundance of the revelations, a thorn in the flesh was given to me, a messenger of Satan to buffet me, lest I be exalted above measure. Concerning this thing, I pleaded with the Lord three times that it might depart from me. And he said to me, 'My grace is sufficient for you, for my strength is made perfect in weakness.'" Paul said, "Therefore, most gladly, I will rather boast in my infirmities, that the power of Christ may rest upon me. Therefore, I take pleasure in infirmities and reproaches and needs and persecutions and distresses for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then I am strong." Well, Paul was a brilliant man, the leading scholar of his generation, and also one of the more righteous in terms of the flesh. In terms of the law, he was one of the most righteous men of his generation before his conversion. But he said in Philippians 3, "The things that were gained to me, I counted them as loss and like dung, so that I might win Christ." And Paul says, God even had to reduce me to abject weakness. He put some thorn in my flesh so that I would not be exalted above measure. But that's okay, because when I'm weak in this way, then I'm strong. I could give many illustrations that preachers have given over the years, whether it's Hudson Taylor or Corrie ten Boom or Johnny Erickson Tata or whoever you want to name. There's been many, many people over the years who have illustrated that it is only when God has brought them to the point of personal weakness, so that there was nowhere for them to look but to God, that God began to work in their life in a way. As long as a person feels they can trust in themselves, they will never trust in God in the way that is required for salvation. And so Jacob wrestled, and he was strong, but he had to be made weak. He had to be brought to the point where he was crippled, probably not only physically, probably spiritually. He bore a wound in his spirit, knowing that he had come to a point where there's nothing he could do for himself. He had to throw himself upon God and beg for the blessing of God with tears. And God blessed him when he came to that point where he admitted he couldn't bless himself. He couldn't handle it. He needed God's blessing because he was now a basket case. God says, okay, there you go. Now you're a prince with God. Now you're Israel, a prince with God, instead of Jacob the supplanter. I'm giving you a new name to suggest a new identity. It's like he was born again. Old things passed away, everything becomes new. Now that doesn't mean that he was an entirely new kind of man forever afterwards. We find Jacob not altogether Christian-like all the time in the future, but that's the same with you, isn't it? Are you always Christian-like since your conversion? Not necessarily. But there is a transaction that takes place where the person has got to come and admit, I need God's blessing or else I'll die. I cannot handle it. I cannot save myself. And that's the point that Jacob came to in this rather peculiar story of this wrestling match with God. Now, rather quickly, I'd like to take chapter 33. It says, now Jacob lifted his eyes and looked, and there Esau was coming, and with him were 400 men. So he was still not sure what was going to happen, so he divided the children among Leah, Rachel, and the two maidservants, and he put the maidservants and their children in front, the most vulnerable spot, the least valued women and children, the maidservants, in the front lines to take the first barrage of arrows. Leah and her children behind, and then Rachel and Joseph last, because they were clearly the favorites. They might all get wiped out, but at least Rachel and Joseph would be the last to go. Then it says, he crossed over before them and bowed himself to the ground seven times until he came near to his brother. This apparently means that he approached his brother who had stopped approaching. His brother sees him and stops and waits for Jacob to approach him. Jacob bowed down, then moved forward a bit, bowed down again, and by seven increments, he approached his brother, bowing each time in a very oriental, Middle Eastern fashion. So it's interesting because the Bible actually had predicted when these men were still in the womb that the older would serve the younger. That means Esau would serve Jacob. We never see Esau ever serving Jacob. We see Jacob bowing down seven times to Esau and calling himself your servant. But, of course, the fulfillment that the older would serve the younger is fulfilled not in the individuals, Esau and Jacob, but in the nations that came from them. Jacob actually was very subservient to Esau, at least when they encountered each other. But Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. And he lifted his eyes and saw the women and children and said, who are these with you? And he said, the children whom God has graciously given your servant. Then the maidservants came near, they and their children, and bowed down. Then Leah also came near with her children, and they bowed down. Afterward, Joseph and Rachel came near, and they bowed down. You know, for Moses to record this is really interesting because all of the children of Israel that Moses was leading through the wilderness when he wrote this were the descendants of these children. And he points out that all these children at one point bowed down to Esau. In Moses' day, Esau's people were the Edomites, enemies of Israel. But Moses had to point out to his own people that there was a time when they, because God had brought them so low, they were vulnerable, they had to actually bow down to who was now their enemy and their inferior. And it's a humbling thing. The Israelites should never forget how low and how vulnerable they were at one time, but that God had apparently changed Esau's heart. Then Esau said, what do you mean by all this company which I met? Meaning all the gifts, the animals and stuff that were sent. And he said, these are to find favor in the sight of my Lord. But Esau said, I have enough, my brother. Keep what you have for yourself. And Jacob said, no, please. If I have now found favor in your sight, then receive my present from my hand, inasmuch as I have now seen your face as though I had seen the face of God, and you are pleased with me. Please take my blessing that is brought to you, because God has dealt gracious with me, and because I have enough. And he urged him, and so Esau took it. Once again, by turning it down, Esau might seem very gracious, but this is probably more the regular Oriental custom. Someone offers you a gift, say, oh, no, don't, I don't want it. Oh, I insist. Oh, well, okay, I'll take it. That's just kind of the way those kinds of niceties were transacted. Now, I guess we could ask the question, why wasn't Esau angry? There's two possibilities, of course. One is that he was already not angry, that he'd given up his anger toward Jacob long ago, and his coming out to meet him was simply a gesture of friendship, and that he wasn't angry. But then the question is, why do you have 400 men with him then? One suggestion that has been made is that Esau at this time might have been engaged in battles against the Horites, whose land he later took. The Edomites displaced the Horites from Mount Seir, just as Jacob's offspring later in Joshua's day displaced the Canaanites from Canaan. The Edomites took Mount Seir from the Horites. It's possible, since we read after this that Esau was going to Mount Seir, that he was engaged in a battle against the Horites, and he had some of his soldiers with him. And that Jacob's servant, with the message that Jacob was coming, had intercepted him, and he decided to go off to the side and to greet Jacob, whom he was no longer angry with, since he was nearby, and then proceed on to battle. And that the troops that were with him just happened to accompany him also. They were already with him, and therefore they followed him to meet Jacob and then followed him off to the battle. That has been suggested, and that's possible. That would explain, and probably only that would explain, why he had 400 men with him when it was a friendly errand. The other possibility is that he did hate Jacob, even up until the time that he met him, almost. That when the messenger came and said, Jacob's coming, that Esau, his old anger was burning in him, and he grabbed 400 of his servants, put swords in their hands, and said, let's go out and kill that rascal. And yet, when these droves came, either that or some other factor, God working on his heart, softened him. And so that by the time he reached Jacob, his heart was softened and he changed his mind. Now, against this proposition, people have sometimes said, well, that can't be the case because he didn't even want the gifts. He said, no, you keep your own gifts. But I'd point out he did take the gifts after all, and there's no reason to believe that he didn't really want all those gifts. It may have well just been the transactions of the Middle East that caused him initially to turn them down and wait for them to be urged upon him before he accepted them. We don't know. We will never know what Esau's state of mind had been in these 20 years that Jacob had been absent. All we know is that one way or another, in the providence of God, Jacob no longer had to fear Esau. Esau was now friendly with him, and Jacob could be secure and come safely back to his land. Jacob said himself, you know, I've seen your face as if I had seen the face of God, in verse 10. That's kind of a play on words, because the place was called Peniel, the face of God, where they met. And Jacob had in fact seen the face of God the night before, wrestling with him all night. Now he has another reason to say, it's as if I've seen the face of God. It's like God's face is shown on me. God's favor has been exhibited by the fact that your face is a friendly face. Last time I saw your face, it was not very friendly. And it's as if I've seen God's face, God's favor upon me in seeing your face friendly toward me. Then Esau said, let us take our journey. Let us go, and I will go before you. But Jacob said to him, my Lord knows that the children are weak, and the flocks and herds which you're nursing are with me. And if the men should drive them hard one day, all the flock will die. Please let my Lord go on ahead before his servant. I will lead on slowly at a pace which the livestock that go before me and the children are able to endure until I come to my Lord in Seir, which is apparently where Esau was on his way to. Now, there's no reason why Jacob should go to Seir. Seir was not in the land of Canaan. It was outside to the east and south. So it's not clear why Jacob suggested he would go to Seir and meet Esau there. Apparently he knew Esau was going there. But Jacob, as far as we know, never did go there. Or if he did, it is unrecorded. But he says, you go on ahead to Seir where you're going, and we'll join you there later. And Esau said, now let me leave with you some of the people who are with me. But Jacob said, what need is there? Let me find favor in the sight of my Lord. So Esau returned that day on his way to Seir. And Jacob journeyed to Succoth. Now, it is possible that between verses 16 and verse 17, that Jacob did go to Seir, even as he suggested. But nothing happened there of significance. He might have just had a feast and then turned back and gone to Succoth. It's hard to say. But Succoth actually means in Hebrew booths. And it's apparently so called because he built himself a house and made booths for his livestock. Therefore, the name of the place is called Succoth. Then Jacob came safely to the city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan. When he came from Paddan-Aram, and he pitched his tent before the city, And he bought the parcel of land where he had pitched his tent from the children of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100 pieces of money. Then he erected an altar there and called it El Elohe Israel. Now, first of all, it says he came to Sukkoth and built a house, which is a more or less permanent structure, and booths for his livestock, which suggests he kind of intended to stay there. It does not say whether he visited his father first. His father was somewhere else. Though I believe there's evidence comes up later that he did visit his father first. We just don't have record of it. And it is likely his mother was dead by this time. We never read of her again, though we do read of Isaac again after this. But although there is evidence that he wanted to stay at Sukkoth because he built a house there in booths, yet we read in verse 18 that he came safely to the Sea of Shechem and he pitched a tent there. So if he built a house in one place, why did he leave there and pitch a tent somewhere else and live in a tent if he had a house in one other place? We're not told. But we do know for sure that he was not in land that was recognized to be his. God had promised it to him, but the Canaanites in the area did not necessarily acknowledge his claim on the land. And it's possible that he camped as long as he could. He squatted, really. He was a squatter, a homesteader there in Sukkoth. But that maybe the natives of the land didn't like it, like the Indians, you know, against the homesteaders in our own history. You know, they built houses, but sometimes they were driven out by the natives. And it's possible that the Canaanites made him too uncomfortable there, and he had to move along and live in a tent after all. He came to Shechem. And there, possibly, that's why he bought a parcel of land. He had plenty of money before this. He could have bought land in Sukkoth, possibly. But maybe the neighbors were too hostile. But the people of Shechem were willing to sell him a piece of land where his tent was. It's the first piece he bought. And perhaps he bought it so that he wouldn't be driven out this time, as he had out of the former location. I'm only guessing, but we don't know otherwise. This piece of land that he bought is the same, probably the same land that he mentions in chapter 48 when he's bequeathing blessings upon his own sons before his death. In chapter 48, verse 22, speaking to Joseph, he said, "Moreover, I have given to you one portion above your brothers, which I took from the hand of the Amorite with my sword and my bow." Now, the sword and the bow is not literal. He bought this land with his money. But the sword and the bow, I think, is a reference to what happens in the next chapter, chapter 34. We'll talk about that later. However, later on, in John chapter 4 and verse 5, we see Jesus is in the land of Samaria. And he stops by a well and he meets a woman there. And we are told that this well was on a parcel of ground, in fact, the same parcel of ground that Jacob gave to Joseph. And at that point, Jesus met a Samaritan woman and evangelized her. It says in John 4 and verse 5, "So he came to a city of Samaria, which is called Sychar," which is the same as Shechem, where Jacob had camped, "near the plot of ground that Jacob gave to his son Joseph." Well, we read of this giving it to Joseph in Genesis 48:22. We read of him securing the land near Shechem or Sychar in Genesis chapter 33. So he here buys this land outside Shechem. The first piece of property that Jacob actually owned in the Promised Land later was the first place that Jesus evangelized, the Samaritans, a non-Jewish woman. Because in the time between Jacob's time and Jesus' time, the Samaritan people were a mixed race, descended partly from Jews and partly from Gentiles. But the land was in their possession. And Jesus, sitting at a well that was on this land, this very land that Jacob bought here, made his first convert among the Samaritans. In fact, a whole city there became converted. All the people of Shechem, who were Samaritans in Jesus' day, became converted. However, in the next chapter of Genesis, we find all the people of Shechem get slaughtered. But it's the same location where later all the Samaritans living there were converted through the woman's testimony and through their meeting Jesus. So he erects an altar and names it God, the God of Israel, in verse 20. And that's the first time Jacob ever actually names God as his own God, as opposed to just the God of his ancestors. So there's a new relationship here between Jacob and God, though that doesn't make Jacob a perfect man by any means. And we find that he has his failures and foibles
even in the future. But we'll have to save that for another time because we've just run out of time for this session.